From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. To many Southerners, barbecue is a verb, a noun, and a religion. Right now at the Atlanta History Center, you can wander an exhibition called Barbecue Nation. It explores the influences, traditions, and techniques of the South's iconic cuisine. John T. Edge is director of the Southern Foodways Alliance and author most recently of the book The Potlicker Papers. When we spoke earlier this month, I asked him, where should we even begin?
There are a bunch of different ways to do that. We could talk about barbecue's move from the East Coast to the West and the way that sauces change and the meat cooked changes as we move from East to West. We could talk about the impact of immigration, both forced and willing, upon barbecue and how we define it. We could talk about kind of microclimates within barbecue, wherein a white sauce like we find in North Alabama kind of coalesces as a style and then spreads out. There are a bunch of different ways to talk about barbecue and to try to define it in this moment. We just got to choose the one we want to talk about today.
See, as I said, this gets complicated. But is barbecuing, is that just throwing a slab of meat on the grill and letting it cook over time? Barbecuing?
You trying to bait me?
Well, what I read in one of your books or stories was about the wearying labor of barbecue.
One of the reasons I believe that Americans valorize barbecue in this moment is that after a long, long time of looking away from that labor, looking away from the working class men and women who were responsible for barbecue as a craft in America, for the longest time we looked away from that labor. And now, after all this time, we begin to regard the men and women who stepped into the smoke every day to cook. And those were working class, oftentimes working class African-American Southerners. And now we finally get a moment where we understand or begin to understand, attempt to understand what they put into what has become America's most fabled and beloved folk food. So this is a great moment to think about barbecue.
Well, let's get into some of the questions about what makes barbecue then. Some people in the South say if it isn't pig, then it isn't barbecue. What do you say?
I say that most of those people live in the eastern half of the South. If you live in North Carolina and you talk about barbecue, you are talking about pig for the most part. Having said that, I took a trip through the eastern flank of North Carolina not that long ago and found a pocket of African-American pitmasters in eastern North Carolina who were cooking whole turkeys instead because they were concerned about the negative impact on their health of too much pork. So what for me I took away from that is absolutes when we talk about barbecue get you in trouble. So to say barbecue is pig is to step in a ditch you're never going to get out of.
Why did pork become the most popular meat here in the South?
Because pigs feed quickly and readily and gain weight quickly, take on weight. Pigs are a great frontier food. Bring pigs along, they eat the slop and convert that feed into flesh really quickly. So it's an economical food for a frontier people in the beginning. And to cook a whole, think about a cow, to cook a whole cow, the sheer weight of a whole cow is far greater than that of a pig. A pig, a 200-pound pig will feed a crew who's harvested the tobacco in North Carolina or the crew that's harvested the cotton in Alabama. It's the ideal size to feed a crew.
Let's get into some of those microclimates that you mentioned. What is it about the style of barbecuing in Georgia? Is there a difference from different places?
Georgia barbecue in many ways reflects those kind of microclimates. If you look, say, in the Chattahoochee Valley in southwestern Georgia, you will see a microclimate of mustard-y sauce, not mustard sauce, but mustard-y with a little Y on the end of the mustard. You'll see a mustard-y sauce microclimate there that extends over into Alabama. And there are places like in Alabama, you'd find a place like Chicken Comers in Phoenix City, Alabama. And across the line in Georgia, you'd see similar kind of mustard tinges in the sauce. And in South Georgia, too, those reflect, in many ways, those styles begin with one pitmaster. One pitmaster who moved from somewhere else, brought that style to a community, and then codified that style as they opened a joint, and then the pitmaster who apprenticed with them goes on to open their next joint, and you see kind of in concentric circles emanating out from one barbecue joint, you see many, and you see a style start to coalesce, and it usually begins with a kind of alpha pitmaster who develops a style or borrows a style from somewhere else. Over time, as barbecue goes from kind of a feast food to feed laborers to a commercial food served out of small restaurants and cafes, then those styles really at that point are codified, and we begin to think of, okay, the style of sauce and meat cooked in Middle Georgia is X, and in Southwest Georgia it's Y. That happens as we go from feeding farmhands to feeding interstate travelers and to feeding suburban families.
How about the dry rub versus wet? Is that localized?
That's a question that is best asked in Memphis, Tennessee. Charlie Virgos, who's a pitmaster in Memphis, Tennessee. And actually, he's not a pitmaster. Charlie Virgos, who was a restaurant owner of a place called The Rendezvous in Memphis, he is a man, was a man of Greek ancestry, who in an interview with Lola's Eric Eli, who made a great film called Smokestack Lightning, Mr. Virgos said, quite frankly, you know, I'm a white Greek restaurant owner. I took a style that I saw popular, a style of cooking ribs that I saw popular among African Americans and moved from the country into the city, moved from rural Mississippi or Tennessee or Arkansas to Memphis. And I took that style and that knowledge and I adapted it by adding my own Greek seasoning mixed with some hotter spices. And I built this style of dry rub ribs. And in that interview, he talks very frankly too about how he borrowed African American technique, fused it with this spice rub that he owes to his Greek ancestry and a love of spicy Cajun food. And a one style starts to codify. And that style starts to codify in Memphis and then spreads out.
Well, you've certainly visited a number of barbecue joints. In fact, there's a series of little mini documentaries of some various hot spots around the country that you visited. One is Valentina's Tex-Mex Barbecue. This is in Austin, Texas. Let's hear just a little bit of Chef Miguel Vidal.
Mexican-Americans from El Paso, Del Rio, Laredo, or across Texas in general, what they're doing in their backyard, the influence that they've had from Texas food and the Mexican influence coming in, that combination that's not in restaurants, that's what sets us apart.
John T. Edge, your book, The Potlicker Papers, this details this debt that's owed to African-American, those nameless cooks that you talked about earlier, immigrant cooks in today's Southern cuisine. So how about that, chefs like Miguel Vidal? How are food traditions of other cultures changing barbecue?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Miguel Vidal does, what he does in Austin, Texas, referencing his San Antonio roots, is he's forging a new tradition in this moment. He is sampling two different cultures, referencing what we already know of as barbecue in the American South, and saying that the next generation of pitmasters, if the previous generation of pitmasters were oftentimes African-American men, the next generation of pitmasters, many of them, are Mexican-American men. So if that's the case, and that labor is done being done by Mexican-American men, then the future of barbecue looks a lot like what Miguel Vidal cooks. And that's an important stance to take. It's not fusion. It's not cultural fusion. It's an honest reflection of who's doing the work and how Miguel Vidal grew up. And I think that's really exciting because barbecue shouldn't be this kind of ossified thing that we don't want to change, that we want to arrest the change of. Barbecue, like any cultural product, is dynamic and reflects the people and places of the American South. And Miguel Vidal and Valentina's is a great example of that.
Well, what are some of the most exciting things that are happening now in barbecue that are keeping it from being ossified?
I mean, one of the best examples of that kind of honest cultural borrowing, I think, takes place just inside 285 in Atlanta at Heirloom Barbecue, where Gion Lee and Cody Taylor work a barbecue restaurant that borrows from her South Korean upbringing and his Tennessee and Texas upbringing. And you see things like kimchi coleslaw. You see dishes like pork rubbed with gochujang before it's smoked. Again, that reflects the honest porosity of cultures that defines Atlanta right now. To cook hyper-traditional barbecue in Atlanta makes a lot of sense. It connects to the agricultural roots of the state of Georgia. But it also makes just as much sense to cook Korean Southern barbecue because that reflects this diverse, crazy quilt of people that claims Atlanta right now. So both can exist, both should exist, both are Southern barbecues. They're just newer definitions of barbecue or exemplified by Heirloom.
Well, kimchi coleslaw, you've introduced the whole specter of sides to this conversation. And there are questions about, you know, what's the best side of sweet sauce, hot sauce, wet, dry. There are some pretty impassioned debates over barbecue. Why do you think it inspires such sometimes really fierce antagonism?
Yeah, I mean, barbecue is this totem of identity for Southerners. We've talked about place a lot, you and I, today. I come from this place and this is how we do barbecues. So in a way, to talk about barbecue is to talk about patrimony. It's talk about who you are and to whom you belong. So when you claim barbecue and claim it for your place and someone else steps into the conversation and says, you don't know what you're talking about. Where I come from, barbecue is something entirely different and our barbecue is far better. It's like saying my hometown's better than your hometown. It goes back to high school football. It goes back to just our American want to claim our place and to fall in love with the place from which we come over and over again. That's what barbecue instills in us, or that's what barbecue kind of inspires in us, is a better way of putting it.
My guest is John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. Just ahead, the racial history of barbecue in the United States. But first, more of my conversation with John T. Edge. This is On Second Thought.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world. And every place I've been ain't quite nothing like. In the morning and gravy too. Fried chicken in the afternoon.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Right now at the Atlanta History Center, you can wander an exhibition called Barbecue Nation. It explores the influences, traditions, and techniques of the South's iconic cuisine. John T. Edge is my guest. He's director of the Southern Foodways Alliance and author most recently of the Potlicker Papers. It's a food history of the modern South. When we spoke, I asked John T. if he'd ever had a Lincoln Douglas-style debate to defend his favorite kind of barbecue.
Actually, about 5 years ago, the Southern Foodways Alliance, the organization I direct, we staged a Lincoln Douglas debate. about the relative virtues of the competition circuit style of barbecue or traditional barbecue. And it pitted Brett Martin of of GQ magazine against Wright Thompson of ESPN, both of whom had firm opinions on each. So yeah, I think that's a great form and way of expressing this.
All right, you're going to tell us who won?
There was a agreement to disagree in the end.
Probably the best place to end up. How about for you? Strangest barbecue meat you've ever had?
Strangest?
Mm-hmm.
I'm an ecumenical eater. I'll eat anything. Most surprising.
I'm going to tell you that I had barbecue bologna in Memphis, south of Memphis, that I'd never had before and will never forget.
You think that's odd?
Well, you know, I mean, you just don't see it on the menu all the time.
Well,
look, I'm from New Hampshire.
Right.
I'm not a person.
Bless your heart.
Now, I may be from New Hampshire, but I've been around long enough to know what bless your heart means.
Barbecue bologna. I had a beautiful barbecue bologna sandwich 2 weeks ago at a place called Helen's Barbecue. It's in Brownsville, Tennessee. Helen Turner is a proprietor, and she's one of the few female pitmasters in the South, and she is an heroic woman. When I was there 2 weeks ago, the thing that really struck me was walking around the back where the pit room is, and in the back behind Helen's, there's a concrete floor. There is basically an outdoor pit room with screens around the top. And I stepped in there to go look at the pit, which is basically two control fires, one on the left for burning down the wood and one on the right for cooking the shoulders. And I couldn't spend more than 45 seconds in that room without gasping for air and running back out. And Helen Turner spends all day in that room going back and forth. And that labor in what she puts into making that bologna sandwich impresses me every time. It humbles me. She humbles me. And that's one of the things I think we take away from barbecue. I'm playing around with your question of like, what's the oddest thing you've eaten? None of it's odd to me. It's about locale and what people love. And that barbecue bologna sandwich that Helen Turner serves in Brownsville, Tennessee, I'd walk across hot coals for that sandwich.
John T. Edge, thank you so much for speaking with me.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
John T. Edge is director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, and we're going to take his advice and visit the kitchens of some of the greatest barbecue chefs in and around Georgia for a taste of how barbecue dishes are evolving and reflecting the region's deliciously different cultures. If you know of a great barbecue place that we should explore, give us a call at 404-500-9457. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at OST Talk. Soon after we recorded the interview with John T. Edge, he was in a terrible car accident. Luckily, he's going to be okay, but we wish him a speedy recovery. Barbecue is undeniably the Southern food, and it's serious business. Almost everybody has an opinion on the best way to cook or flavor or serve barbecue. But it's controversial for another reason. Barbecue has roots in slavery, and some popular barbecue restaurants have decidedly racist pasts. GPB's special correspondent Celeste Headley spoke with the Charlotte Observer's food editor Kathleen Purvis, Chuck Reese of the Bitter Southerner magazine, and the culinary historian Michael Twitty about barbecue's checkered past. And Michael started with the difficult part, the politics.
It's political by the very fact of the nature. It was the food that fueled political gatherings. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing about it, is that this was a food tradition that was used to manipulate and lubricate the course of American democracy, and the fact that for so long, and even to this day, the power source of that democracy was among the Southern elite, and that's undeniable. I mean, from Washington to Jackson to post Civil War to even today, that barbecue is a major way to manipulate and sway the course of who votes what.
Kathleen, why is that? Why did barbecue become the type of food that is so often associated with political gatherings and rallies?
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One of them is that it's something everyone enjoys. The other reason is because when we're in the campaign season is typically when hogs were slaughtered. And it was the time of year to do large barbecues. It was after the harvest was when people were considering who was going to be on the stump. And you want to get a whole bunch of people together and put them in a really, really good mood. You put a pig in a hole in the ground and cook it and then give it away.
And Chuck, do you think it's fair to say that barbecue is just a truly, regardless of its roots in Africa and in the Caribbean, but at this point, is barbecue an American food?
Well, yeah, I guess it is. But, you know, the thing about all Southern food is that it has elements of African and Caribbean cuisine in it. You know, the easiest thing to look at is a pot of okra. I mean, almost every Southern cuisine has the influences of people who were brought here against their will originally. But there are things, you know, there's also a little joy in that when the things do come together to make a great dish. You know, food brings us together to talk about the things that are difficult to talk about. Honestly, it's really, usually when I'm talking to Kathleen and Michael, we're talking about this kind of stuff, but there's whiskey involved.
Michael, when you go back in the history books and try to trace back some of the early masters of barbecue, most of them were African American. How did we now get to a place where many of the sort of well-known chefs of barbecue are white guys?
So that you may as well ask the same question about the banjo and the blues.
There you go.
You know, the three B's, you know, went from the Blacks to the Bubbas. And I mean, this is, you know, I want to go back to what Chuck said and what you said. Well, that upset people. You know, that's the problem. You know, one of the things I've written about in, you know, sorry, shameless plug, my forthcoming book, The Cooking Gene, is the fact that, you know, we have to get over these missing branches and missing roots in the Southern family tree, cultural family tree, and genealogical and genetic family tree that go back to African origins. And the bottom line is that they aren't barbecuing in Liverpool. They're not barbecuing in Bristol. They're not barbecuing in Kent and Somerset, you know, where Southern British folks came from, or Dublin, or Westphalia. They're barbecuing in Africa and the Caribbean, though, African native people. And the bottom line is that one of the things that's really insulting and problematic about the way the black agency in barbecue has been described. And I think that's why the banjo went the same way. Remember, the banjo was like, everybody knew it was an African instrument. And then the banjo became a tool of mockery through the minstrel show. And it was used to, both in the South and the North, to demean black cultural aesthetics and creativity. So in the South, it was used to say, yep, these people are as inferior as we call it. In the North, it was used to say, see, Irish immigrants, you're better than them. And the same thing with barbecue. Barbecue, we were told, oh, yeah, old man so-and-so will barbecue for us. This black man, uncle so-and-so. Well, uncle, that's already disrespectful. They think it's honorific, but it's really not. It was a way of not calling a black man sir. And then, you know, that poor black man who's paid pennies and given a leftover plate of food, he doesn't get anything for his work. He's a master craftsman. Robert Moss says that they are recognized black barbecuers, and other authors too, and they're very true. But most of these folks are poor. They're given leftovers. They're given pennies for what they do. And when they do it, by the way, and this is my last point, people talk about them as if they're machines, as if they're animals, as if they're trained automatons to do the job by white people. And that was Bessinger's problem, and other folks in Texas. That's their problem, too. The idea that when black people did it, we were just trained to do it. But a good Southern white man knows exactly how to do it and do it well. Because he has the brains, but the blacks have the brawn.
So another shameless plug, one of the first attempts to reclaim the heritage of the banjo was in the Afro-American Symphony, which was the first orchestral work to use a banjo, written by my grandfather, William Grant Still, grew up in Arkansas. Kathleen, let me then read you another tweet, and that's from Roy Lee, who says, I thought fried chicken was the most political food. What do you... What do you say about that?
I think that that is, once again, getting into stereotypes and the assumption that all we eat in the South is barbecue and fried chicken. And, that's kind of I can understand his point, maybe, but I think it's kind of limited. I also think that one of the reasons, Michael, that we get into this ownership idea is because the work of barbecue is terribly difficult labor. You have to be over hot coals 12 hours and do it again the next day, do it over and over again. And the people who could afford to open the restaurant, pay for the pigs, tended to be white. And the people that they paid to cook it tended to be black in the 20th century, I think. And that doesn't, I'm not defending that at all, but I'm just saying that there is, both sides come into play with barbecue.
Michael, I want to read you this tweet because it sounds like, forgive me, Leonard E. Henry, who sent this tweet, if I am mischaracterizing your tweet, but it sounds very facetious to me. He says, which is more racist, mustard sauce or ketchup-based barbecue and made from pigs? Islamophobic. My goodness. So let me be the devil's advocate here, Michael, and say, look, it's just food. What if I...
Nah, it's never been just food. It's never been just food. When Tiger Woods was at the top of his game, he was just an American. He was an American who acknowledged all of his different parts. And when he did that as a human being, the first thing they did was lob at him fried chicken or collard greens or whatever the hell they eat. You are an outsider by virtue of the fact, and they didn't focus on his Asian or Native or European ancestry. They focused on that one part that pissed them off, and that was being African. And so I'm going to put it to you right now. Until people are willing and able to define for me and talk about the Nigerian, Ghanaian, Senegalese, and let's go to the next level, Wolof, Yoruba, Congo, roots of what it means to be a Southerner and an American, they can cut that. Because the bottom line is people don't know. These things were obfuscated, they were buried, because they offended the sensibilities of white supremacy. And now that we have a voice and we can talk about these things, now it's not important anymore. At least, you know what, I love the writings of slaveholders and people during antebellum slavery. You know why? Because at least they gave us a little bit more credit than people do today.
What do you mean?
They when things were black, they said they were black. And they had no problem saying that because they held the keys. The mistress held the keys to the kitchen and the master held the keys to the big house. But guess what? They had no problem saying we were the best. The best chefs, the best barbecue men, the best everything. And they had no problem saying that it was our craft and our skill came from the fact that we were of African descent. At least they gave us that while they whipped us.
Todd Ream tweet. Todd Ream tweets...
I'm not playing.
Clearly.
He never does.
Todd Ream tweets, when I was in law school, some students would road trip to barbecue restaurants from Supreme Court civil rights cases. And Chuck, I'm sure that there is a feeling among some people that they don't want to have to think this deeply about food. That they just, if they like the taste of a kind of food, that they just want to eat it without having to worry about all of this heavy history.
Well, you know, such is the dilemma of intelligence, you know? I mean, it's like, here's the thing that I like about, or here's the thing that all of this tends to bring me to. What you're seeing in discussions like this is Southern culture shifting on the fly. Mm. You know, because here's the thing. Yeah, we can eat these foods and not worry about it a bit. But if we have some curiosity in us and we all want to know about our roots, now we're at a point, and it's because people like Michael are out here doing this work that we're at this point, we can go deeper into those roots than we ever have, And it's going to be tough. It raises dilemmas, but it's worth doing. And the food is tasty.
That's Chuck Reese of the Bitter Southerner magazine speaking with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. We also heard from Charlotte Observer food editor Kathleen Purvis and the culinary historian Michael Twitty. Just ahead, join us for some Brazilian barbecue. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're exploring the history and delicacy of Southern barbecue. The Atlanta History Center has an exhibit that takes you through barbecue culture in America. And that tradition, like the rest of the country, is increasingly global. We went to get a taste of some Brazilian barbecue. In Portuguese, it is called churrasco.
Good food.
Nelsir Mueller is from Santa Catarina State in southern Brazil, but now calls Georgia home. In fact, he just became a U.S. citizen. He's worked in Brazilian barbecue restaurants, or churrascarias, in Brazil and in the U.S. since the late 1990s, and is now general manager of Chama Gaúcha in Atlanta. We joined him just before the lunch rush at his kitchen in Buckhead.
Wow, so this is where the magic happens.
Yeah, here is where we cook all the meats. As you can see, it's... we use real charcoal. This is called picanha. That's our house specialty. It's a very traditional cut at the south of Brazil. And then we have tabarão sirloin. It's in the US also, they call it flap meat. And of course, we have the wonderful ribeye here. Also for the red meats, as you can see, we are gonna use only rock salt. Just put a little bit of rock salt on it.
So no spices?
No spices on the red meat. We only marinate a little bit lamb and the pork cuts.
So if I were with you in Brazil right now, would this be pretty much the same thing you would be doing there?
That would be exactly the same thing, yeah.
After he salts the skewered meat, Nelsir mounts it on a rack where it begins to slowly turn over a bed of very hot coals.
To start, you're gonna put it very close to the high fire. This is gonna sear the outside, and then it makes the keep the juices more inside. Helps protect the meat to be more a little bit juicier.
The restaurant's doors are about to open, but the kitchen looks nearly empty. Nelsir's demo appears to be the only thing happening.
Now you all are about to start lunch. Is there other meat in other places that is being cooked right now?
No, not right now. We cook everything fresh.
So that is one thing that distinguishes Brazilian barbecue from our slow-cooked meats down south.
Well, it's not gonna cook all the way through because the way we serve, we are gonna slice it thin, slice on the outside, and then we come back, we add a little bit more salt and give it another. Misky charcoal still sparkling a little bit.
As Nelsir prepares the meat, two of his employees lay out another essential part of the Brazilian barbecue, the salad bar. Jesus Mayo and Andres Batista are hammering ice with a mallet.
I mean, the process actually takes maybe like an hour or so, like with me and him.
A lot of the people working at Chama Gaúcha are Brazilian, but these expert ice crushers are from Mexico.
I mean, they speak Portuguese to us, so it's kind of like sticking into it. We're trying to learn Portuguese also.
How's that going?
It's kind of good sometimes. Sometimes with
tudo
the other.
Bem?
Tudo bem?
So how'd you become the ice guy?
Well, they just actually, when I came to apply, they just like, I think they saw something in me and they just put me right here. And since then, it's like 2 years ago, I've been doing the ice this whole time with Jesus or with Valente. It's hard for most people in the beginning. It was actually hard for me. I took like a whole month just to do it. But I mean, like I'm telling you, like after you get the hang of it, you're just like really, really quick. Just like in any other job, any other process in a job, you're really quick when you get the hang of it.
The salad bar is filled with colorful dishes and so big that I have to take a tour before deciding which to sample. I think what we have to do is find out what this Brazilian vinaigrette is, because that's like the sauce, yeah?
Yes. At the South of Brazil, we eat a lot of vinaigrette with the meat. This is basically very simple, green pepper, tomatoes, yellow pepper, onions, and vinegar.
I need to ask you about this thing here. Heart of palm. That looks beautiful. Does that really come from a palm tree?
It really comes from a palm tree. Yeah, it's grown mostly at the north of Brazil.
Back in the kitchen, the first cut of meat is ready, and we are ready to taste it.
That's the most traditional cut in Brazil, what we call picanha.
Picanha.
Yeah.
Wow.
The way we skewer it, the fat outside, so it then we sear it on the hot fire, keeps all the juice inside.
It does completely melt in your mouth. And it's interesting because you just put the rock salt on the outside. Obviously, I'm tasting an outside piece, but that, it just tastes beautifully salty, not overdone.
Yeah, rock salt, usually with rock salt, it's not easy to oversalt it versus marinated it with tin salt. Or rock salt, usually the meat almost absorbs only what it really needs.
To us, churrasco is just plain delicious. For Nelser, it transports him to the countryside that he left nearly 20 years ago.
When I smell and taste the meat and the smell and the flavor, it brings me back home to Brazil. I remember mom and dad when they were cooking and we grew up cooking. I left home when I was about 22 years old to really put in practice what we had learned at home.
We're starting to work up a sweat in the kitchen, so we tuck into one of several private dining rooms to ask Nelser more about the churrasco tradition, which, along with soccer and samba, make up a kind of holy trinity of national pastimes in Brazil. You know, you said that you grew up in a place where your family would grill meat.
Mm-hmm.
Do many Brazilian families do that?
Down at the south of Brazil, we still have a lot of families that do that. And for example, we still have a small farm where my dad runs it right now, where we raise cow and we slaughter and we cook it with real wood grill and everything's just done right there.
So a lot of families do that kind of thing?
Yes, still do, yeah.
So what does that mean to your family when you were growing up, right? I know that a lot of family traditions, they just happen. You don't think about
mm-hmm.
them, right? So you just grew up with every weekend you would do this?
Every weekend and sometimes just a family, sometimes in small communities where they used to gather like gather a party for the church, for example, everybody pays a little bit and then they cook that the barbecue, the churrasco, and then the money all went to the church. Kind of not exactly a donation, but supporting the church and meanwhile meeting your neighbor and your friends. And so it's just traditionally, yeah.
And it's mostly men do the cooking in this case, yeah?
Mostly men do the cooking of the meats. Usually ladies, mom and sisters, they were in charge of the salads. So they start kind of early, prepare the salad, and then if you don't have a rotisserie grill, sometimes the meat needs a little bit longer, half an hour, 45 minutes to cook. That's the time when people sit around the fire and enjoy chimarrão, which is the green tea we drink at the south of Brazil, or caipirinha, It's mandatory to have a caipirinha before lunch.
And this is just on the weekends you would do this?
Yeah, because during the week everybody works, so it you like Saturday and Sunday. Sundays, almost everybody's off on the farms, and then it's when they used to do that.
So do you remember being a little kid thinking, I'm going to someday grow up and start grilling the meat too?
Yeah, you know, it happens so fast. We grow up so fast and get old too fast. But yeah, when specialist holidays like Christmas and those were big days always.
Well, so that sounds like a kind of down home, you know, kind of experience. But restaurants like this, Chama de Gaúcha, mm-hmm. Fogo de Chão, they're fancy places. I mean, this is it's a beautiful restaurant. This is some place you would take somebody for a special dinner. Mm-hmm. How does that homespun thing translate into a fancy restaurant in the city?
Well, it all happened when I was 22 years old. I moved to São Paulo. Things on the farms, agriculture for the Brazil was kind of very tough for small farmers at that time. So we decided to go after new opportunities. And yes, we had to adapt the way we cook and even some of the salads to bring that experience to fine dining restaurants. But the main ideal is always the same, you know, the way we prepare the food.
Do most people have a place to grill? What do you call it? The
churrasqueira.
Churrasqueira. Do they have those in their home?
I do.
You do? Yeah. You mean you don't get enough at work?
Yeah, I eat meat every day at work. On my day off, I still grill at home. I really like it.
Okay, you're a tall, thin person, and you eat meat every single day?
Every day, yeah. So I think I need to, well, I don't know if it has to do with the food or how much we exercise or genetics could be, I don't know. But really, if you really look our, the way we grill, there is almost no deep frying, you know. We only fry polenta and bananas, and then we have rice and beans, of course. And traditionally at the south of Brazil, we eat really, really heavy. We eat a lot of potatoes, yuca, a lot of meat, rice and beans every day. And sometimes, if we are still hungry, a little bit salad.
Save salad for last. So you've lived outside of Brazil for more than 20 years, yeah? And your brother is also in this business?
Yeah, my brother, when I was about 3 years already in U.S., had the opportunity to come to U.S. and then he's been here for about 18, he's about 15 years right now. So he runs our location in Chicago.
So I'm thinking of your grandmother and grandfather. What would it be like for them to step into the kitchen here where you have those beautiful rotisserie grills?
Yeah, well, probably grandfather and grandmother, they used to do a hole in the ground and then cook it. Because by far then, I don't think very few people had grill at the south of Brazil. Now my dad has, everybody has, but back, I remember when I was very young, I went to my cousin's wedding when I was maybe 6-7 years old, and it was about maybe 60-70 people. They made that big hole in the ground, and that is where the barbecue was cooked.
Wow, so they just put a bunch of hot coals in the ground and then put the meat on top of it?
They really put wood, burn the wood, and then when it becomes like coal, charcoal, then put the meat on the top of it.
And everybody stands around and waits?
Stands around for half an hour, until everything's just done.
I wonder at 6 or 7 years old if you thought, I'm going to grow up and do this.
Yeah, and then things changed, it became sophisticated, and now we are here. But the same concept still.
Meat, heat,
yeah.
Rock salt.
Yeah, there we go, you learn it.
Customers are circling the salad bar as I sit down with two of my colleagues to sample some of the sides, purely for comparison's sake. OST producer Leighton Rowell has spent a lot of time in Brazil, and it shows.
When I lived in Brazil, I would go to friends' houses in Rio Grande do Sul, the Gaúcho country, and their mothers would always prepare, of course, well, their fathers would do the churrasco, the actual meat, but their mothers would make the sides. They would make the salad, they would make the mayonnaise, the potato salad. And something about the mayonnaise name was so strange to me as an American, because it's just a sauce here. But Brazilian women often, like I would say Southern women, make their own mayonnaise for that salad. So it's not a super processed condiment or anything like that. It is homemade, just like churrasco.
And we quickly realize that even the tiny helpings may be too much. We try the potato salad, mayonnaise, the hearts of palm, the beets, and the tabbouleh, all nods to Brazil's varied population. It is, like America, a nation of immigrants and a country with an economy built on the backs of African slaves, all contributing to its mix of food and culture. The servers are all men.
A very delicious fried banana. We also have a homemade mashed potatoes. And we also have a fried polenta.
Nelser did mention that most gaúcha grillers or churrasqueiros are all men. And that may be one more point where Southern and Brazilian barbecue part company. Along with traditional Brazilian sauces like chimichurri and mint sauce are some nods to American preferences. There's smoked salmon in the salad bar, and grilled shrimp is now on the menu, as is chicken wrapped in bacon. But there's also something no one would dare pair with pulled pork in the U.S. of A. Pão de queijo, or cheese bread.
The bread is great. Service is awesome. You know, here to have a good time.
That's Tefatu Chan. She was celebrating her graduation from Lakeside High School with her family.
How do you not just keep eating and eating and eating and eating and eating?
Well, the thing is, don't eat before you come here. Don't drink anything until last. If you drink something, you'll get full. And that's not the point here.
The point is to fill up.
Yes.
That is one question that may unite barbecue lovers across the globe. You can see photographs from our visit to Chama Gaúcha in the Buckhead neighborhood of Atlanta at gpbnews.org. And we would love to come and visit your community and sample some of your favorite barbecue. So let us know, what is your favorite barbecue hang? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter and on Facebook at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. May you fill all the pits in your life with barbecue. Ave Cruz, Vege Crispy.